Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the capture in Jordan and the trial in New York of Osama bin Laden's son-in-law that is reviving the war within the so-called war on terror, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham vowing to make sure Sulaiman Abu Ghaith is tried in Guantanamo. Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst and author of Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad, joins us to discuss the battle over Guantanamo that the president has vowed to close and Republican senators seem determined to keep open. Then we'll look into the issues raised by Senator Rand Paul's filibuster against the new head of the CIA over the use of drones in assassinating American citizens that have made Rand Paul something of a hero on the political left, while at the same time his message resonates with his true base of support on the libertarian right and among anti-government militia groups. Paul Pillar, the CIA's former National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, joins us to discuss the Central Intelligence Agency's more paramilitary role that John Brennan is inheriting, and when and how concerns over drones that American citizens on the left and right have will be satisfactorily addressed. Then finally, we'll examine the new report by the Southern Poverty Law Center on the four-year explosive growth of conspiracy-minded anti-government patriot groups that have intensified rage on the right against America's first black president. Criminologist, civil rights attorney, and professor of criminal law, Brian Levin, joins us. He was associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. Joining us now is Peter Bergen, who is CNN's national security analyst and the director of National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. He's traveled and reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and in 1997, he conducted the first television interview of Osama bin Laden for CNN. He is a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden, The Osama bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, and his latest book, out soon in paperback, is Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Bergen.
Hello.
So, what do you make of this war within the so-called war on terror that's going on between Senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain and the White House? It's now been revived over the capture in Jordan and the trial in New York of Osama bin Laden's son-in-law.
Well, you know, I think it's sort of a storm in a teacup on multiple levels. You know, this guy, Sulaiman Abu Ghaith, made a sort of poor marital choice, it turned out. You know, he's Osama bin Laden's son-in-law. That doesn't mean that he was an operational player in al-Qaeda. And in fact, a videotape recovered by U.S. soldiers in Kandahar, which was then publicly released around December of 2001, showed bin Laden sort of kicking back with Sulaiman Abu Ghaith and others and talking about the 9/11 attacks. And he says, look, this was so tightly held that I didn't clue in Sulaiman Abu Ghaith. So the defense lawyer in the case is surely going to put that on at the trial. And the the charges against him seem very thin. They're conspiracy charges, not that it's not, you know, they're worth pursuing, but this is far from somebody who's a, you know, a kind of war criminal. And I don't think you could put somebody on trial in Guantanamo on conspiracy charges anyway, since they're not a war crime. So, you know, it belongs in New York. There's 100% conviction rate in terrorism cases in New York State and in Manhattan. In particular, obviously. And, you know, this guy is going to face a pretty long sentence, and I'm sure we'll try and do a plea bargain and explain what is of great interest, which is the al-Qaeda folks that were living in Iran for about a decade, including himself, you know, what that arrangement really consisted of.
Well, that, of course, is something that apparently he's already, hasn't he been debriefed, or he's been supposedly being quite cooperative with his captor so far, and he was captured, I think, a couple of weeks ago, was he not, in Jordan?
Yeah. I mean, he's given a 22-page statement. We don't know what's in that statement, but, that could well be the content of the statement.
So why is Senator Lindsey Graham then, Peter Bergen, why is he so exercised about this? And he's vowed not to take this lying down. This he wants the trials in Guantanamo, as does his tag team, John McCain, on this issue. They've sort of single-handedly kept Guantanamo open. So what's the heart of this battle between the president, who's vowed to close it, and these two Republican senators in particular, who seem determined to keep it open?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's just them. I mean, the Congress has voted, to prevent, for instance, Guantanamo prisoners, any money to be allowed to that would transport Guantanamo prisoners to the United States. And in fact, it was not either of the two senators you mentioned who first kind of prompted it. It was I think it was Frank Wolf of Virginia who first kind of pushed back when Uyghurs, the half dozen Uyghurs who are basically Chinese Muslims from Western China, there was a move to bring them into Northern Virginia, and that really precipitated this whole sort of NIMBY response to all this, which was we're not going to take any Guantanamo prisoners anywhere in the United States. And of course, that had knock-on effects because I think it made it less likely that other countries would accept them. And the Uyghurs, I think, ended up, as it turned out, I think, in Bermuda, finally. So, it's not just these two senators. They're making an issue of this particular point. But I think, the broader this has, there's a lot of support in Congress to essentially take actions that would make it very hard to close Guantanamo. That's just an unfortunate fact.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, who's CNN's national security analyst and director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. His latest book, out soon in paperback, is Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. So, Peter Bergen, what do you make of the extraordinary statements coming from Ahmad Karzai of Afghanistan, who's now more or less implied that the United States and the Taliban are working together to conspire to have American troops stay longer in Afghanistan, apparently against his wishes. We've had some pretty bizarre statements from this erstwhile ally, but this one seems to, particularly when it happens when the new Secretary of Defense is visiting Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, it's implausible on its face. The only way that statement could be in any way defensible is it is a fact that U.S. contracting payments have over time ended up in the hands of the Taliban because, although then there's much better safeguards to prevent this now than there were maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but, by the nature of any kind of construction project in Afghanistan, you've got to pay people off to protect it, and often those turn out to be sort of local warlords, some of whom maybe admit themselves to paying off the Taliban to prevent some kind of attack on a construction project. But, that's a defensible version of, U.S. aid, ending up in the hands of the Taliban. What Hamid Karzai is saying, that the U.S. is conspiring with the Taliban to essentially prevent a drawdown of American troops in 2014, it fails every common sense test. I mean, the Taliban really does want the United States to pull out.
Well, there's a very, very powerful documentary made by BBC's Panorama. I don't know whether you've seen it, but it paints a pretty dismal picture of the Afghan army and the police and their abilities to take over from the United States. I mean, you got these guys stoned all day and illiterate.
Well, I've been out on patrol with Afghan policemen and they're smoking weed and stuff. I mean, that, in parts of Afghanistan, that's a pretty kind of common thing. I don't want to defend, certainly the Afghan police is often not a particularly effective force. The Afghan army, I think, is a slightly different issue. If you go in public opinion polls, Afghans repeatedly give very high marks to the Afghan army, and although it's still got a long way to go, the fact is that they are transitioning into control of quite a number of the provinces of Afghanistan, and there's a sort of chicken or egg problem. They're never really going to show their capabilities if the United States is constantly sort of backing them up at every twist or turn. We'll see. Hopefully that they will be able to resist the Taliban And at the end of the day, it's our country, I'm somewhat sanguine that they will.
Well, but there appears to be a bit of a difference on our side about how many troops are going to be left behind. The commander in Afghanistan has doubled the number that the White House has apparently suggested would be the number. So what's happening there, do you think, Peter Bergen?
Well, I think, there's a debate about it. And, I mean, I think I think also in the White House, it's not exactly a uniform, I think Vice President Biden probably would want a much lower number, closer to zero. As he said in the vice presidential debate, he said we're getting out of Afghanistan at the end of 2014 period, which isn't really the case. I mean, we've conducted quite a lot of U.S. government time when it's a negotiating strategic partnership agreement with Afghanistan that basically keeps us there in some shape or form to 2024. And as you've indicated, there's a debate about what those numbers are. But my guess is when all said and done, and this is something that's going to be wrapped up this year, you're looking probably at 8,000 to 10,000 American troops. And then probably as a result of that, there's a NATO mission, it's not just a U.S. mission at all. Other NATO countries will continue to, keep advisors, et cetera. You might be looking at a few thousand other NATO countries' troops in Afghanistan going forward after the 2014 withdrawal of all combat troops. So, there's going to be a presence. It's not going to be large, and that's probably a good thing, but it's not going to be nothing, and that's also a good thing, because at the end of the day, the Afghans want to be reassured that the United States in particular and the international community also isn't just going to sort of turn off the lights in December of 2014 and just leave, because they're very concerned about what that would mean for them.
So the issue, of course, of drones came up in no uncertain manner in the Senate this week with a filibuster by Rand Paul against the all but certain confirmation of John Brennan. And after 13 hours, Rand Paul gave up with a letter from Eric Holder assuring him that an American citizen would not be hit by a weaponized drone drinking coffee in San Francisco. He gave a bunch of examples. But in the area that you've been covering, the AFPAC area, there's been a little confusion over the use of drones. There were some drone strikes that the CIA said they had nothing to do with and the U.S. military had nothing to do with. What's going on there? Are the Pakistanis sharing these platforms?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think it's a very good one. It's quite unusual for the CIA to sort of disavow a drone strike completely and sort of, on the other hand, it's something that, they haven't been exactly completely transparent about in the past. So I just don't know what to make of that. Certainly the Pakistanis have drones themselves. About 70 countries now have drones in some shape or form. Have they got to the point where they can arm them and conduct these kinds of attacks? I'm a little skeptical of that notion. Is the United States and Pakistan cooperating on drone strikes to some degree? Certainly in the past they have, yet the whole situation is complicated by the fact that the Pakistani parliament actually voted in April to prevent CIA drone strikes on their territory. So it's a very murky story. Lots of people have pretended something that wasn't true about aspects of this program. And the story that you cite about a couple of drone strikes in February, which no one is taking credit for. I think that's sort of we don't really know the answer to that, I don't think.
Well, Peter Bergen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Bergen, who is CNN's national security analyst and the director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. He's traveled and reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and recently Egypt. In 1997, he conducted the first television interview of Osama bin Laden for CNN, and he's a New York Times best-selling author whose books include Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden, The Osama bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, and his latest book, out soon in paperback, is Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former senior CIA official about targeted killing, drones, and torture. Oh! And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Pillar, who has served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously, he served as Chief of the Analytic Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence's Counterterrorism Center from 1997 to 1999, and was Director of the Center. Paul Pillar is currently a Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He, along with a group of senior military officers, recently signed a full-page letter to President Obama in the Washington Post, urging Mr. President say no to a war of choice with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Pillar.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And what do you make of the filibuster of Rand Paul in, by Rand Paul against the all but certain nomination of John Brennan to head up the CIA, in the sense that he has obviously become perhaps a temporary hero on the political left, but at the same time, his message resonates with, I think, his more authentic base, which is on the libertarian right and to some extent amongst anti-government militia groups. So politically, what is going on here in terms of a broad spectrum of American people, even though I believe 83% of Americans support the use of drones against in terms of target assassination, yet there is obviously a real disquiet and an unusual alliance here on the left and the right.
Well, politically, there are several things going on. First of all, I would salute Senator Paul for actually doing a stand-up talking filibuster, which is something we haven't seen for some time. And a lot of people expressed disappointment when we had this so-called set of reforms to the filibuster a few weeks back that Harry Reid and company did not go as far as to go back to requiring senators to actually do what Rand Paul did. He's clearly making a splash in another respect. It's hard to imagine another young, pretty new senator getting all the publicity he has. But setting aside all those political aspects, I think there's still a couple of other levels here. You are quite correct that for most people, the drone program is not something that should be discarded. It is seen as a legitimate tool in the eyes of most Americans to go after terrorists. Nonetheless, especially, though not exclusively, because of the way U.S. citizens have been involved as targets, and this, of course, goes back specifically to the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, in which he, as well as one of his colleagues and his teenage son, were targets, or at least they were killed by drone strikes in Yemen. There have been issues that are of concern, and I think legitimate concern, on both the libertarian right, with which Rand Paul is associated, and what we could describe as the civil liberties left, as to this whole program as an instance of executive power perhaps going farther and going more unchecked than many Americans believe it ought to be. And that's the final sort of political dimension at which the Rand Paul filibuster was operating, I think, and he's made this clear himself. The immediate topic was the drone program, but he's speaking more broadly about the issue of executive power and just how checked or unchecked it ought to be.
Well, in terms of the Senate and the issue of filibuster, which you just raised to Paul Pillar, it's extraordinary to think that at the same time Rand Paul got all of this publicity for his stand-up filibuster, which harkens back to the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, at the same time there was a silent filibuster of a judicial appointee to the very important circuit court in D.C., which has four vacancies, including the vacancy left by the now Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. And it's pretty clear that the Republicans are simply holding up appointees to this key court that makes incredibly important decisions and also is feeds a lot of justices to the Supreme Court itself.
That's right. And some editorial writers made exactly the connection you did, noting the contrast between the stand-up filibuster on the drone strikes and what we have come to see as routine, which is the silent filibuster, if you can call it that, which is basically if the minority says nothing's going to go unless you have 60 votes, it's not going to go. We're talking about the D.C. Court of Appeals here, which, as you noted, is generally considered as the most important circuit court, not only because it's a sort of feeding ground to the Supreme Court, but in its own right, it handles the lion's share, the great majority of cases involving federal departments, simply because it is here in D.C. And on these sets of issues that we began talking about, things like the counterterrorist powers and how they may affect and raise issues of due process and so on, it has been the key court by far at the appellate level. And what we have right now politically is a situation in which there, because of the vacancies on that court, conservatives see themselves as having a majority with the sitting justices, and so they see it in their interest just to keep the vacancies from being filled. The latest talk I've heard about the possible Democratic response to this is for the president possibly to come up with multiple nominees to fill vacancies and then challenge the Republicans to try to come up with legitimate-sounding reasons why all of the nominees supposedly are not qualified for the court.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Pillar, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He also was Deputy Chief of the Counterterrorism Center from 1997 to 1999 and is currently a Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. Let's turn to the more paramilitary CIA that John Brennan is inheriting. And obviously, his predecessor, ill-fated as his tenure was attracted, at least if you heard the tape that Bob Woodward managed to get hold of, that had an emissary of Fox News offering the presidency to General Petraeus, and he at one point in the tape he mentions that he's really interested not in being the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, which obviously wasn't being offered to him, but he was interested in heading up the CIA because he thought that was where all the action was going to be in the future. So, is it a new agency now? Is it not just about gathering intelligence and analyzing intelligence? Is it more of a paramilitary organization?
Well, first of all, I think we should give some credit to David Petraeus, who I think came across pretty well in that tape, in not jumping at Roger Ailes's offer of having Fox News be a basically a presidential campaign support team for him. His desire to head the CIA was legitimate for very legitimate professional reasons, and I take my hat off to him for that, regardless of everything else that has come up subsequently. But on the broader question that you ask, Ian, about the nature of this agency, the main thing I would emphasize to your listeners is, what we hear publicly and that gets all the public attention is not a fair or accurate representation of how the work and the priority and the resources and the personnel are distributed. We hear a great deal about something like the drone program because it is a point of understandable controversy. But in terms of people and dollars and priority, it's really a very small part of what takes place. The much larger part is the traditional intelligence functions of collecting and analyzing information on what's going on overseas. And for the great majority of officers who come to work each day, that's what they're doing, or supporting those functions, and their relationship to something like firing missiles from drones is basically reading about it in the newspapers just like the rest of us.
Well, I'm sure you remember the long and repeated testimony from William Colby, which led to the church and park committees and led to the President Ford banning assassination. And, of course, assassination is at the heart of the drone issue because it is an instrument of assassination in as much as a sniper rifle is, I imagine, except that it's more high-tech and it seems to elicit a very passionate emotional response from a lot of people, both on the libertarian right and on the left, in terms of it being raising some serious moral issues. But I have a broader question just about in general, and that is that throughout the history of the CIA, it's been the presidents who have used the CIA as almost the favorite toy of the executive branch, and going through Jack Kennedy and others, even though he vowed to smash it after the Bay of Pigs, he used it with a vengeance, and others have. And the strange thing is that the president is sort of immune from criticism about everything gets essentially blamed on the CIA. And I'm wondering about this current issue now of how much the White House has tried to keep the drone program as secret as possible. And now, as you know, the Rand Paul and others are sort of smoking them out and they're not really getting ahead of it. So are we back to that pattern where somehow the executive branch is immune from criticism when in fact it's the one that's pushing the envelope, or is that, if that's indeed the case today?
Well, you're making a couple of very valid points here, Ian. One is there's a tendency by us, the public, to confuse institutional issues with policy issues. You referred back to William Colby in the 1970s, and in terms of law and procedure, we've come a long, long way since then. In fact, the key changes were made in the 1970s, and that's when we had established a legal framework for covert action, which requires the president by law to sign what are called findings, which are the authorizing documents. And it's not a matter of the CIA or any other one agency going off and doing its own thing, not by a long shot. And it's kind of ironic when we talk about the drones today, because we have reportedly the CIA doing things with that technology in some areas, and then the military using the same technology in other areas. And it's particularly strange when you get to South Asia, where if something takes place on one side of the Durand Line in Afghanistan, it's the military doing it, and if it takes place on the other side of that border in Pakistan, it's reportedly the CIA that's doing it. I see no reason why the principles and the restraints and the legal framework shouldn't be the same all around, regardless of which particular department of or agency the president chooses to use as his executive agent for carrying out a particular program. Now, historically, the CIA has gotten involved with a lot of these things because it happens to be the organization that has an overseas clandestine capability, which is there primarily to collect intelligence, to collect information that cannot be used or cannot be collected in any other way. And that gives you a tool, a capability that you may not find in any other department, even in the military, which, of course, has the physical capability to do a lot of things, but doesn't have the clandestine nature in most of its operations. But your basic point, I couldn't agree more. We shouldn't confuse the policy decisions and the issues those raise with institutional questions in terms of who's carrying something out.
So what was your reaction then, Paul Pillar, to what Rand Paul was saying, because it elicited a very angry response from John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who dressed down their junior colleague on the Senate floor?
Well, I'll leave it to more senior senators to express their own opinions about what the more junior ones should or should not be doing. I personally am sympathetic to what Rand Paul was doing insofar as he was trying to highlight the importance of the issue of legal transparency and consistency, and seeing to it that we in the public even though we ought not to expect to have access to the ins and outs of classified information in individual cases, we can't expect that. We ought to expect to have access, and our members in Congress to have access, to the rules and the legal framework that underlie something as significant as the killing overseas through aerial means that we've come to know as the drone program. And so far, that transparency has only been grudgingly and in a limited way been granted by the administration. We've had a couple of these legal memos that reportedly members of the Intelligence Committee have been permitted to see, although without staff and they can't take notes, and it's a really difficult framework for them to exercise oversight. But I think it would be quite proper, and this is the direction that Rand Paul was arguing for, to have a more transparent framework and one that can be readily debated openly.
Well, of course, how this so-called kill list is generated is a big question, and the rigor with which that's done, and the methodology, too. I mean, we don't know whether they're using computer analytics and all of these kind of things to put people on these lists. And, I mean, as a former intelligence officer, how do you feel about the nexus here between secrecy and the public's right to know?
Well, I agree with you. And I was speaking of legal framework, but it's more than just legal framework. It is a matter of criteria and process and rules that go beyond the strictly legal issues. The distinction to make here is, you know, we as a public cannot expect to find out everything about individual cases, about why Ahmed X someplace in Yemen has become a target, because that almost certainly will involve classified sources and methods and properly classified ones.
Well, and also if you revealed it, he would no longer be a target. He'd go into hiding.
Exactly. That's the limitation. But what you're talking about, you know, the criteria that can be phrased in a more general way as to why someone gets on a list, I see no reason why that should not be more a matter of public scrutiny and discussion than it has been. Because after all, this gets to the heart of what we as citizens and our representatives in Congress ought to be doing in the way of weighing often conflicting principles and criteria and values, in this case, ones involving our security as well as due process and other important things to us. They don't always lean in the same direction. That's why we elect politicians, especially members of Congress who exercise oversight over the executive branch's activities in these areas, to make those sorts of weighing-type decisions. But they simply have not been able to do that because of the lack of transparency with most of what we're talking about.
Well, Paul Pillar, just in the last few minutes, I'd like to turn to the other roiling issue, if you will, and we talked about it earlier with Peter Bergen about which has come up with the arrest in Jordan and the forthcoming trial in New York of the Bin Laden's son-in-law, and it raises again the question of this so-called this war within the so-called war on terror, in as much as the president wants to close Guantanamo and others like Senator Lindsey Graham want to keep it open, and they're vowing to make sure this guy gets tried in Guantanamo, and it raises the question again of the so-called torture issue, which was in many ways revisited by the movie Zero Dark Thirty. A lot of people, I spoke to Glenn Carr, a former CIA officer who was involved with interrogations, and he was upset with the film, as was the Senate Intelligence Committee. And at the same time, you've got people like the CIA officer Rodriguez essentially saying that this is how we got all these bad guys, including bin Laden, was through torture. So it seems like there's confusion within the intelligence community itself about whether torture works or doesn't work, or whether it's legal or appropriate. So where do we stand?
Well, first of all, I would express my pleasure with the fact that this suspect who was rounded up in Jordan is going into a proper Article III civilian criminal court in New York. And I have little patience for those like Senator Graham who try to make an ideological point that, well, this is a war, so we ought to do everything in a military tribunal. I totally sympathize with the administration on this one. In not adding one more prisoner to Guantanamo when we're trying to reduce the population there. You know, on the torture issue, this again is one that goes far beyond any one agency or the intelligence community or the Justice Department or any other one component. This is an issue for all of us as Americans to consider in a way that takes account of how our own referring again to the broader public, view of this has changed over time. And the long and the short of it is, in the immediate years after 9/11, there was a much greater tolerance for this sort of thing, for what's now known euphemistically as enhanced interrogation techniques. There was a public mood in favor of taking the gloves off and getting the bad guys and not restricting ourselves. And then it's only subsequent to that, over the more recent years, that people have understandably started to have qualms about this. And I think we all ought to recognize how the public and congressional mood has changed on this. And I think one of the frustrations you're seeing a little evidence of when you get statements from retired officers who might have been involved in this program is the frustration that comes with seeing the standards and the criteria shift under their feet as the public mood changes, and to be asked or expected to do one set of things at one time, and then after the public mood changes over the next few years, to be seen as the target of recrimination and the focus of demands for accountability. So rather than confusion, I think it's more that kind of frustration that you're seeing some evidence of.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Paul Piller.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Piller, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously, he served as the Chief of the Analytic Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East and Persian Gulf and South Asia. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence Counterterrorism Center, which from 1997 to 1999, he was the Deputy Chief of the Center. Paul Piller is currently a professor of security studies at Georgetown University and is a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He, along with a group of senior military officers, recently signed a full-page letter to President Obama in the Washington Post, urging the president, Mr. President, say no to a war of choice with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how both the left and the right share anti-government delusions. We are the robots. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. He was also a New York City police officer in Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And your previous organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center, have released The Year in Hate and Extremism, a report capping 4 years of explosive growth sparked by the election of America's first black president and anger over the economy. And, of course, the number of conspiracy-minded anti-government patriot groups have reached an all-time high of 1,360 in 2012. And while the number of hardcore hate groups remained at 1,000. So this rage on the right has obviously intensified under President Obama. And there was, of course, this filibuster that took place by Rand Paul was celebrated by a lot of people on the left. But it's worth reminding people that a lot of the audience that resonated with are on the right, and some of them are in these anti-government militia groups. So what's going on here in this left-right confusion?
And thank you so much for having the vision to look at this in a broad context as well. So let me take that point first, and that is we have mass discontent with the way institutions in the United States are performing, and that includes Congress, the president, local government, the media, and the courts. We are near modern historic lows with respect to confidence in these various institutions. So put an overlap with that, or an intertwining, if you will, of people coming from different perspectives. On the left, there were those who saw the issue with regard to Iraq as an example where the government was not forthcoming. Then you had 9/11 and conspiracy theorists on all sides. On top of that, put in an economic crisis, immigration, and the diversification of our demographic characteristics. And on top of that, we now have the first African-American president who is putting forth a pretty moderate progressive agenda at best. And no matter where you are on the political spectrum, there will be people who are now very sympathetic towards a distrust of government, and with that, conspiracy theories, in part because the government has not performed exactly in a stellar manner.
But Brian Levin, the thing that I find troubling is that this is increasing alienation towards the government, both on the left and the right. And on the left, people tend to be passive. They just sort of drop out and don't participate in the political process, which then, of course, yields the field to the political right. But on the right, they are clearly far more active and, I would say, more dangerous. And that's what the Southern Poverty Law Center's report is talking about. You know, as much as the people on the left think Rand Paul is a hero at the moment because of his stand on drones, he's also pushing heavily against this idea that Obama wants to take your guns away. And there's so many beliefs on the right that are just completely unfounded, unhinged, that Obama is an interloper, a Muslim from Kenya. There's a whole kind of toxic stew of delusion out there that I find really scary.
You know, I hate it when you make your points better than your intended guest. You are exactly right. And I think that while there is a similarity with regard to the fact that there are conspiracists and people who are disenchanted with government on both sides, I think you made a very key point with regard to the extreme right. And I'm not talking about people of goodwill who happen to have been Romney supporters. I think we're seeing something here, and that is there is a folklore on the extreme right that panders to some of the more intolerant viewpoints with regard to demographic change, number one. Number two, there's also this very key point about the right to bear arms, which with some on the far right goes to illogical extremes that even stand in the face of Scalia's constitutional analysis of things. On top of that, put in the fact that unlike the Democrats and the left, who have a leader who has a bully pulpit who can kind of try and rein in and direct where the public policy analysis goes. In other words, we have a president, we have a Speaker of the House. The Republican and right wing is much more fractured. And what that allows is a sliver of folks like Congressman Gohmert from Texas or Rand Paul as well to appear to have one foot in bordering on the extreme and one foot in the mainstream. That being said, I think that Senator Paul hit a nerve with regard to a growing distrust of overarching government authority in the name of national security. And while a lot of people on the left don't like him as a messenger, the fact is he certainly acted, as my friend Mark Potok would have said, a transmitter for some general discontent which goes over from the mainstream into the extreme as well. And I think there's a danger there because, as you said, on the left, a lot of the folks are dropping out or being ignored. We have a small sliver that are involved in the eco-terror movement, but that's much smaller. On the right, what we're seeing is people who are politically engaged but holding on to these conspiracy theories, whether it be about Obama or guns or whatever else. Then you have folks that are dropping out, just as there are on the left. But you also have this dangerous extremity which relates to the militias. And that we're not really seeing on the left. In other words, these groups that are arming themselves. And that so we have kind of a tripartite danger. One, that there is a sliver of the Republican Party or mainstream conservatism which is increasingly embracing these kind of extremist views. Number two, we have folks who are dropping out, as we've seen on the left. And number three, we have these militia groups. Not, by the way, most of these militia groups are benign, but the mere fact that we have armed groups running around embracing conspiracy theories and various types of intolerance is troubling.
Again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He previously served as the associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And last week, the Southern Poverty Law Center released its annual Hate Watch report, which is what we're talking about here. And in terms of Rand Paul being a kind of a lightning rod here for both the left and the right in his 13-hour talking filibuster, which in many ways was very helpful to bring up the issue of drones and targeted assassination. But again, as much as he was appreciated by people on the left who feel passionately about the use of drones by the government, he did venture into territory that was pretty. Now, by the way, the Obama administration has not been forthcoming, and I think their attitude towards him, particularly the letter from Holder, was kind of patronizing, but it ended the filibuster. But a couple of the things he said, both he and Ted Cruz, is another one of these anti-government guys on the right. They both have suggested that somehow you could be sitting at a cafe in San Francisco and get zapped by the United States government. And that drew an angry response from both Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham. So is this going to lead somewhere, or is this just basically political confusion?
You know, there's something going on here, because on the one hand, let me not dismiss people as loose cannons or nuts or anything like that. Here's what I think is so interesting. There is a legitimate debate going on about what is the role of the government with respect to our privacy and with respect to our own personal security. I think everyone can agree with that. What I find is so interesting is that the vehicle by which this debate is coming into the foreground is through something that is really looked at by the extremists. And that is, in other words, this whole drone thing has been a wildly hot topic in the extremist world. So why they would use the instrumentality of drones as their central focus on an overall legitimate topic of public debate, to me, is incredibly interesting and perhaps a bit scary. Senator Cruz is actually a highly intelligent attorney who has a background in constitutional law and has written Supreme Court briefs. So one would think, for instance, that he would know what the rules are with regard to the government use of force, particularly domestically. So what's interesting is how these legitimate topics of debate get intertwined with folks and hot points from the extreme world. And that's something I wish I could articulate better. In other words, why are we debating this very important macro topic from a position that is the least likely to immediately happen, and one that, while admittedly something that perhaps we should look at, is a bit on the tangents right now? Certainly, drones are becoming an increasingly talked about and utilized asset by Department of Homeland Security and law enforcement. But it would seem that the debate, if there is one, for CIA head, would go to things like internet scrutiny or business records and a variety of other things relating to the use of force beyond that merely being fixated on drones in particular. And that, I think, because drones have a currency because they're part of the popular culture. And I think in some ways that while Rand Paul's position is a sincere one, it seems to me that there's something that just doesn't smell right about having drones be the topic of a filibuster with respect to the incoming head of the CIA when there are so many issues with respect to personal liberty and protection beyond merely that of drones. Drones is a very hot topic, an effective image, but it by no means is the main thing that would threaten Americans' personal civil liberties right at this moment.
Well, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, did answer Senator Cruz, his hypothetical about zapping somebody drinking coffee, and he said, well, first of all, it doesn't even sound like there's grounds to arrest this person, let alone assassinate them with a government weaponized drone. So what Paul and what Cruz and company are saying are so over the top, and that's what concerns me, is that so much of these Alex Jones people who also made the film about the 9/11 truthers use, the loose change. He's screaming about taking our guns away. These people are quite deranged, I think, in their delusions about government intrusion, which is, the opposite is happening. There's a proliferation of guns. There's no chance in the world that anybody's going to take their guns away. So that's what concerns me, is that the proportionality is being lost here, and that the left are asleep, not recognizing the dangers of the right.
That very well may be the case, but let me play a little bit of devil's advocate, and as someone who is an admirer of President Obama here, and that is that these questions should have been really answered by the administration before giving a platform to somebody else to ask them. And what that did was, I think exactly as you said, it played into a folklore about the extreme purpose of private firearm ownership, which is some way to be unlimited and to be a complete barrier to equal in some way to what is available to the government. So if the government has drones, therefore we can have anti-aircraft guns. You see my point. And I do think, though, that, and again, this is from an admirer of the president, is that the president really did not address the legitimate questions that were out there with regard to national security and how that impacts on personal liberty to the extent that it satisfied both people on the left and the right, thereby giving someone like Senator Paul the opportunity to then frame the issue in a way that would not only appeal, in fact, it was kind of brilliant, appeal to the left, appeal to libertarians, but also appeal to those extremists who believe that, unlike other fundamental rights, the Second Amendment enables you to own any weapon you want, anytime, anywhere. And I think in some ways the administration dropped the ball on this by not answering legitimate questions about what the government can and cannot do. And one of them came up with regard to Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed on September 30th, 2011, in a drone strike in Yemen. And there are plenty of reasons that the president could have given that were distinguishable from the kind of more fantasy one about using drones to just sit, you know, hit somebody in a cafe somewhere who he didn't like his political views. Anwar al-Awlaki was involved in not only rhetoric, but involved in a foreign-based terrorist organization that was involved in multiple attempts to strike the American homeland, of which he was supporting that. And he was inaccessible to American authorities. That's vastly different than hitting someone with a drone in a cafe. It may still not be fully defensible from a constitutional standpoint. I'll leave that for others. But it is at least factually distinguishable from what has been put up on the internet and then kind of embraced by these mainstream politicians. So perhaps the administration could have been more effective in saying, look, these are the limitations that we have, and talking about it in a more public manner.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, as always, thank you so much. It is such a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.